Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome to the Capital Club Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Adams. Every week, we bring on some of the brightest leaders around the world to discuss issues facing high net worth individuals and family offices today. Hello, and welcome back to the Capital Club Podcast. Today, I have with me Anthony Vanette. As Director of Business Valuation and Advisory at DeJoy & Company, Anthony provides estate planning and business valuation consulting services to his clients. His focus is to optimize gift and estate tax for business owners to help maximize their legacy. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Brian. Excited to be here and talk to you and your audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been reading a number of your articles about compensation and structuring in our business. In the family office recruiting world, working with privately held businesses or family offices, compensation and structures are very top of mind right now because attaining and retaining talent is one of the biggest challenges that folks have given this demographic shift occurring between baby boomers and Gen Xers and millennials. And this is your area. So before we get into what's going to be a pretty nitty-gritty granular conversation, would love to just get high level who you are, what you do, how you got to be focused on what you're doing today.
Yeah, my name is Anthony Vanette. I'm with DeJoy & Co. I'm a director of our business valuation and advisory practice. So I kind of see us sitting at the nexus point between those generations, right? Capital coming over from the baby boomers over to Gen X millennials, right? How do we facilitate that handshake? We really exist in that space. I consider it the succession and exit planning space. In terms of my background, I started my career at PwC in their tax group, decided tax work wasn't for me, and went and did some valuation work with a national firm for 5 years, then decided I was open to exploring the next opportunity and found myself back in a CPA firm, which I didn't think when I left PwC I'd end up back here, but enjoy a lot of the work I do today. It incorporates a lot of that tax background, as well as evaluation issues, and then just the transactions I've been a part of, you know, the families I've helped over the years. I think I got kind of taught through, you know, 500 lessons of real world examples. So trying to carry that forward and push that on, bring some of these strategies that I've seen at the higher end where these conversations happen when you have 250, 500 million, $1 billion net worth. But these conversations should be happening if you have $50 million net worth. I think $20 million, $10 million net worth. These conversations should be happening. So helping facilitate those and bring those strategies down to people who can still benefit from them but aren't getting talked to about them.
Yeah, it's a huge issue right now. And I agree with you. I think there are obviously folks kind of, I think the world is kind of bifurcated if you have an estate tax problem or not, right? And even if you don't, though, I think it's really smart to think through kind of the intersection between income tax and estate tax. And, yeah. and you really are that interface there, which I think is a really interesting place to be. So let's start it this way. You're interacting with clients all the time. You're getting ready for your busy season, I assume. What's top of mind? Like, what's front burner for a lot of these family offices and entrepreneurs that you're talking to on a daily basis?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the biggest issue today and over the next probably year or two will be an exemption sunset. So we can go back to basics here, talk about gift and estate tax and how that functions, right? So speaking specifically to the federal U.S. gift and estate tax, your net estate will be taxed at 40% along with gifts made over lifetime. However, you have a lifetime exemption amount, right, which currently is $13.6 million, so functionally $27.2 million for a married couple. That amount increases for inflation every year. Obviously, we had a big jump in 2018 when the tax, well, the act formerly known as the Tax Cuts and Job Act, went into effect. That doubled that amount. That sunsets on January 1st of 2026. So we're looking at probably $7 million, $14 million for a married couple, right? That huge drop in exemption changes the pool of people involved in this completely, right? So we bifurcate the world between I have an estate tax problem or I don't have an estate tax problem. A lot more of us are going to join that circle pretty soon. So how do we plan for that? And even if you're over that amount, right? Let's say I'm definitely over that amount, whether it reduces or not, there's still a planning opportunity for that exemption that's expiring. That is now a user-loser opportunity. So how do we deploy that in the most effective way possible? We have a lot of these pre-tax compensation conversations. Let's talk post-tax. And certainly that conversation gets extended if we're talking about legacy, right? If we're talking about what's going on in the next generation. That's what the gift and estate tax is there to capture. So how do we best set ourselves up, A, to deal with that in a compliant and appropriate manner, but B, to do it efficiently and planning long-term for our personal and familial financial goals?
Yeah, I think this is the conversation to be having right now. So what are some of the baseline, basic structures and schemes that people should be familiar with and at least should be asking their tax and legal professionals about?
Yeah. So I take kind of a principle-based approach to this, right? So when we think about that tax issue, right? The big thing to understand is we can bifurcate what's gift tax and what's estate. So once I gift it, it's out of my estate. So that's now a timing difference because our gifts are taxed on the date of the gift, whereas our estate is obviously taxed on our date of death, right? Now we have an opportunity where we actually have some control over what affects timing. So now we sit here, we roll over from the tax concept over the valuation concepts, right? Back to your first day in finance 101 at college, right? We're talking about what is value, and that's just the confluence of cash flows, time, and risk. Cash flows are cash flows. Just let them be. We don't have any control over those, but time and risk we can control. So when we think about assets that make sense to transfer over, obviously cash isn't very effective. One, right, where it's not very efficient. Even marketable securities don't do that. But if we have an interest, let's say, in a privately held business, something that has potential for rapid appreciation, those are the items to target because, right, we gift them at a lower value, lock in that low value. Let's view our gift as that opportunity. And then over time, right, it could grow outside of our estate and then avoid having the estate tax on that appreciation. So for me, that conversation naturally gravitates to out of the money options, right? Which functionally, that's what a profit interest or carried interest is. It's just an out of the money option. Certainly when we're talking about time zero, pre-time zero, in some type of fund structure, right? So that's the strategy that I'm targeting clients and saying, hey, what's the most rapidly appreciating asset in your portfolio? How do we move that over in an efficient manner? And then we can talk about vehicles, right? We can talk about different trusts that make sense. A lot of that's going to start catering to your personal kind of, you know, specificities, what you're looking for. So it's funny, I have these conversations with clients about estate planning. The first hour I'm talking to them is just about them. Their lives, their family, their goals, what makes them tick, what gets them out of bed in the morning, what do they want to be the legacy, what do they want people to say 10 years after they died, what do they want them talking about? How do we set you up for that? I always think that our profession sits in this position where we're helping establish and preserve legacy. My work's more in the preservation than the establishment, but that's a key principle right there. A lot of that has to understand, what do you want that legacy to be? How do I help you tell that story?
Yeah, I think starting, that makes a lot of sense. What I've seen working with families oftentimes is it's papered correctly, right? Yeah. So the trust and estate, you know, killing them on paper, tabletop exercise flows really well. There's no hiccups. It's super efficient, really, really tight technical work. But then when you sit down and you talk to G2 or G3 about it, mm-hmm. it works in terms of a legal perspective, but then there's a lot of questions of, well, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
And you realize that G1 probably just did this and listened to their professionals without the professionals actually listening to what G1, G2, or G3 wanted, right? And that's when things, I think, fall apart, is when the flows happen and there's this realization of, oh, wait, this wasn't actually what the family wanted.
Yeah. Right? What I think, and I often see that exact same problem too, I think authenticity is key to this, right? We talk about some of these vehicles. I can talk in a maximalist estate tax planning approach, which is give all your estate away today, right? That's the easy way. Or let's just give it all away to charity and we don't have to worry about the problem. That's not the reasonable way. So let's talk about other issues that are at play. That's where I love something like a family limited partnership. And a family office is a great facilitator of that. And I've worked with a number of them over my career. And that's what it is really there to fit in. But with a family limited partnership, I don't think of it, although it has estate tax planning benefits to it, those are certainly there. That isn't the driving force. The driving force is now efficiently handing over that capital to an educated group, right? So that's where our quarterly board meetings we're having as a part of a good flip. Those things should be happening, right? Having those discussions. All these conversations should be fleshed out thoroughly and regularly and updated as appropriate over time. That's how we manage that over generations. And that's a difficult place to be in. But that's where having a good professional, whether that's in your family office, whether that's a good CPA, a good attorney, somebody who's used to having those discussions, can translate around to different people, different parties, that's where the benefit comes in.
And that's where when we talk to families, placing that expert generalist is so key, because that person may not be, you know, a hardcore trust and estate practitioner, but they know enough to understand how to communicate it from what the family desires are into the execution with the accountants, with the T&E folks, with the CPAs, with the valuation experts. Talk about, I think a lot of people think about gifting strategies, it's only cash or marketable securities or, you know, quote unquote, liquid assets. Can you maybe touch on how powerful appreciation is, the pay down of debt, and then the closely held business discounts that you're able to achieve,
yeah,
and how they all work together with the gifting and estate tax?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, the appreciation is powerful, right? If we're in a privately held business, and ideally we're getting a temperature check on what that is value-wise, price-wise over time, we can see that appreciation there. In terms of something like a finite fund, like we're dealing with, you know, with carried interest, let's say in a private equity fund, appreciation in that from, you know, day one of the fund out to liquidity events, that's typically 10 to 20% of the fully, you know, appreciated value. So that's a 10x return on either a leveraging of exemption or just gift tax in general. And then that money is now fungible out into my trust, whatever. So where ideally, I'm probably not even concerned about the money, right? I don't want my kids touching us till they're 30 anyways. Maybe they're, you know, toddlers right now. So the timing doesn't matter in that perspective, and we can use that to our advantage. But yeah, we can talk about probably close to a 10x return, maybe 5x conservatively. And part of that is due to appreciation. Another factor that you referenced is minority discounts, right? So these are concepts commonly discount for lack of control and lack of marketability. These are key issues, right? Something that I don't think is commonly understood. Those are typically 40% discounts in aggregate. That's what we're talking about. And that's the difference between a private business and a publicly held one. I can go to my broker tomorrow and get rid of my Apple stock and it'll be in my account in a day or two. Easy. Do that with your minority interest in a privately held business where I have an operating agreement or LPA that restricts me from even transferring my interest without approval of a GP or somebody. Additionally, there's no open market for my interest, right? I don't have control of the company, right? I don't have a vote on the board or my vote isn't controlling, right? Those are the risks we kind of stack up to say, hey, this isn't worth its fully marketable value. Those are huge opportunities that we don't have that option with cash, right? Cash is cash. You got $5 in your pocket, you can go spend it anywhere. So those are the opportunities we're trying to focus on creating for our clients.
Yeah, and that's where I think a structure like a family office can be so powerful, because you can have a full understanding, like the full dashboard up in front of you, right? And everyone's talking to each other, and maybe oftentimes it's probably an embedded family office within an operating company. But that's where these mm-hmm. tax strategies can just become so hugely powerful when you talk about, okay, it's a closely held business. We understand what the market appreciation could be in 5 years. We can throw it into a GRAT. We can put together a debt pay down scheme, and we can coordinate all of that together with a broader trust and estate plan. It's just incredible, because I think you have to remember, we're talking about net of fees after tax returns.
Yeah.
So it's not just about what the underlying revenue growth of that company could be.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, how can we be the smartest within the bounds, obviously, but how can we be the smartest way to transfer those assets in tax efficient manner?
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head earlier of having a generalist involved, somebody who understands at least a functioning working knowledge of every piece of it, not only every piece in a microcosm, but in the macro, right? I can kind of see the whole field. I kind of call that a quarterback role. And I often find myself falling into that, not out of any type of specific plan, but just my background, right? I was doing tax planning for high net worth individuals. I was the one, you know, dealing with all these issues when I was at PwC. I went out, and then I was the guy who was doing all the valuation work, seeing how that works on a detailed level, dealing with M&A transactions, other opportunities too, as you see those. You know, now I'm back in the CPA firm, and I do a lot of the same stuff, and I kind of play that holistic role of like, hey, I know where all the pieces are. I can't do any of them maybe individually, right? I can't write your legal documents for you, but I can tell you what your lawyer should be putting in there, and I can review that for you. So having that really person who knows it all, and that could be obviously a family office. We do see the embedded family office concept come up very often, that I signed up to be a CFO of one company, now I'm a CFO of 20 different companies, and also, hey, yeah, I'm a personal financial planning, you know, guru. And that's where that healthy exercise of sitting down and saying, hey, what is my estate? Because that's such a big question. With entrepreneurs, 90% of that is locked up in privately held businesses, right? It's one thing if, hey, I'm a highly compensated executive at a publicly traded company, and maybe I have a lot of stock. There's opportunities there too, but those are also very visible. So now when we get further away from that, that's where I see conversations stumble, that we can't even start talking about it because we can't put a number on anything. That's what stalls out conversations. That's what I try to get in there. Let me just do that. Let me answer question A, and then we'll go from there. And if there's other opportunities in the future, that's great. Otherwise, at least I've done that much. I've facilitated a further conversation.
Okay. Let's go into nerd territory here.
Okay.
And get into carried interest.
Mm-hmm.
For those listening who aren't familiar with the concept is, could you just give up a layperson's definition of what carried interest is?
Yeah. So let's talk about a super vanilla fund, right? I'm just talking ABC, you know, PE fund. So we throw on the term 2 and 20 a lot, and those are probably not even market terms anymore now. It's funny, I see those.
I'm about to say, that's probably 25 years ago. If you can get 2 and 20 in the market, good for you. You got to be Citadel or something nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more like 1 in 10 these days. But so that 2 and 20, we use that term, what that's referring to. We're talking about a 2% management fee, and we're talking about a 20% carried interest. So a typical fund would function in the way that we have LPs contribute to the firm. We also have GPs typically contribute a small amount of capital relative to the overall piece. The LPs then receive an 8% preferred return on their investment. After that's paid off, we typically fall into carried interest. And now where LPs might have contributed 99% of capital, and that's obviously what they're getting up on the front end of the preferred return at 8%, now it shifts to being 80% to LPs and 20% GPs. So when I think about it, I think about it kind of like, I prefer to take a call option theory. Like, okay, if I think of all these as calls on capital, and now I can sit here and break down technical reasons why you can't actually do that. But from an overall view standpoint, if we think of the carry as an out of the money option, it's my call on capital, but it's out of the money because I have to cover preferred return. Obviously, my AUM to start is below the amount of that preferred return. That right there creates a huge opportunity for planning. It's important to understand all the players involved, right? And that's where private equity is complicated because the structures are so complicated. Understanding the players, the entities involved, what money's going where and when. And that's where I've read, I don't know, hundreds of LPAs that are, you know, 200 pages. I remember the first one I read, I spent 2 days on it. Now it's like, I can break it down in 20 minutes. Just I've seen so many of them.
So can you define, so there's three big documents. There's the PPM,
yes,
the LPA and the sub book. Could you just define what those mean?
Yeah, I work a lot with the PPA and the LPA. So the LPA would be the limited partnership agreement. And that LPA specifically we're referencing is the fund. So we have our fund, we have our GP entity that sits above the fund, and then we have our GPs in there. We also usually have a management company, which is an unrelated entity, but if you look at who's involved in that, it's all the same people as a GP. And then we have our LPs separately, meaning that might even be through another vehicle too. So our LPA, when I reference that, I'm talking about the fund LP, right? Not the fund GP LPA, which is another document too, if you're bored. And then on top of that, we have the PPM or the private placement memorandum. So that would typically outline, so the LPA would outline the legal dictations of how the fund is going to function. A big part of that, obviously, is things such as distributions, capital calls, right? We're talking cash flows, what I'm concerned about. There's also plenty of other details in there. Then the PPM is going to outline, it's kind of the firm's pitch deck, right? It's saying, hey, this is what we're doing. So they're going to outline their investment thesis, right? Their plan, what industries are targeting, sectors. They're going to tell you who's involved. And then for the layman's terms, if you want to read an LPA quickly, find the distribution section of the PPM, read that while you read the LPA, and you'll typically get a quicker translation quickly from legalese back to English. Those are the key documents I'm involved with there. I don't get into the sub-book as much. Just my work doesn't tend to fall into that area. But if you can read those, you typically have a good taste on how the fund is. You also get a good view typically of how this firm has performed with prior funds, right? Which tends to make things a bit easier from my standpoint as well as an investor standpoint, right? So you can look at their last however many funds back to inception and saying, have they been successful, right? What are exit multiples? What are, you know, average IRRs, other data like that, that can be productive.
Yeah. The way I like to think about it is the PPM is a marketing document.
Yes.
Like a hugely regulatory compliant pitch deck, basically. Correct. The LPA is an agreement between general partners and limited partners. Mm-hmm. And the sub book is just a really complicated form.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it can get complicated. So let's talk about how carried interest, now that you've kind of defined it, and do you know where the term came from?
I don't actually know where the term came from.
It's kind of cool. So it was originally during transatlantic trade during like the 16th, 17th century, a captain that successfully would get goods from Europe to North America or vice versa was entitled to 20% of the profit.
Wow. You learn a little every
safely,
day.
Like yeah, I mean, there's your TED talk of the day.
There you go.
It's pretty kind of cool idea.
It is, yeah.
Anyway, so how does, now that we've kind of defined this, how does carried interest work in the context of this previous conversation with gift and estate tax strategies?
Yeah. So functionally, let's take a step back and look at it in terms of the fund waterfall, right? So my fund, I think of it as kind of two sides of the coin, right? I have my fund side where I'm not considering what's split between partners, right? I'm bringing money in through capital raises and capital calls. And then it's going out into investments and then ideally coming back in, whether that's through a yield off my investments or typically through an exit event. We're talking private equity, or this concept applies for venture capital. Hedge funds, it applies as well, although hedge funds just tend to be a different animal just because of perpetual nature involved, but still analogous theories. And then we flip that over and say, okay, like now let's look at how it's split between partners. So like I said, we have to return capital. So we have to make our investments. We have to grow those investments. We have to exit those investments. At that point now, we're returning capital LPs. And at some point, we'll crest over that return, and then we'll venture down into my carry. So that could typically be in a European waterfall. We could be talking year 7, year 8, you know, 10, 12, right, depending on the fund. And then an American waterfall, that can be kind of earlier. And then we can just maybe, for the audience, bifurcate those two. A European waterfall looks at that return, that preferred return on all capital, right? So I have to return every dollar of capital on LP investments before I get into carry, right? Plus my preferred return. In an American waterfall, we do it on a fund by fund or investment by investment basis. So I only have to return capital on a specific investment involved relative to that capital contribution.
Exceptional family offices, family enterprises, wealth management, and financial services organizations require superior leadership to successfully thrive in today's competitive environment. This is why I'd like to introduce you to our new sponsor, Mac International. Mac International is recognized as the premier boutique firm that specializes in providing retained executive search and strategic human capital consulting solutions to single and multi-client family offices, family enterprises, and the full spectrum of wealth management advisory, investment management, and financial services firms that serve ultra-high net private investors and family offices on a national and international basis. If you're interested in learning more about Mac International, visit their website at macinternational.com.
Yeah, American waterfalls, I would say, are very atypical in the States.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not market any longer. I mean, if you can get away with it as a GP, kudos to you. But that's cherry picking is a real problem in that structure.
Yeah, so, correct. Well, so then we think about how that works out. That doesn't matter how many dogs I have. If I have one golden goose, that's going to pay the whole carry. Whereas in a European waterfall, I had to be cognizant across every investment. So then I can think of it in my world. Well, now we're talking about risk. So in an American waterfall, that risk is much lower because I don't care. 9 investments can go sideways. If I have one home run, we're going to pay it out. Whereas in a European waterfall, if one investment goes sideways, that can screw the whole pooch on the carry, right? So these are just considerations. But anyways, getting back to it. So that carry interest is very tail loaded, right? So we go through a big calculation, basically summarize saying, hey, this is when the cash flows are going to come out. And that'll come out literally as one line item saying years, maybe 8, 9, 10, 11, we're seeing distributions coming out. That's why I like to plan at time zero, right? So let's talk about when we do this planning. You can call me in year 6 when you're getting a carried interest payment in year 7 and tell me, oh, I'd love to get this. We can do that, but it's not necessarily going to be very powerful. The power of the strategy comes from doing things with a long gap. So using that 8, 9, 10-year gap to a water, to a cash flow, that's where the benefit comes in from our basic concept of time value of money. So this strategy works really well at time zero or even pre-time zero. I've done a number of these transactions where, you know, we're 6 months before the funds even start. That's just more opportunistic to stack up time as well as risk. Maybe now we don't only have the risk of identifying investments, making investments, exiting investments, right? Everything goes in that. Now we have the risk of raising capital, right? So we're doing a $1 billion fund. Well, now there's risk that they don't even raise $1 billion, and that as a whole will drag down the carried interest value. So those are the types of things I'm typically looking at and targeting. The earlier, the better.
Yeah, I mean, I think two big takeaways based on this last part of the conversation. It's worth it to pay for professionals.
Yes.
You know, I think a lot of investors who don't have a financial services background start allocating capital to GPs or sponsors. And paying for somebody to go through the LPA and the PPM is worth it. And what I always tell people to remember is those documents are there to protect the GPs.
Correct.
They're not there to protect the LPs.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about, I mean, if you're working with Kirkland or if you're a big firm, I mean, those are $1 million PPMs.
Mm-hmm.
They're really smart people. Make sure that it's a heads up transaction,
I guess,
is what I would say. And then start early is the other one, right? I mean, There's just a lot that could be done early in the conversation, and then your options get limited the farther away you get from that transaction event.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's opportunities early. And when I talk to, you know, GP groups, this is what I'm usually talking about, is saying, you know, how can you guys do this together, right? I mean, that should be a conversation that's happening in that year before the fund was started, saying, guys, what's our estate planning prospects, right? I mean, obviously, assuming we're an established firm and we want to do that, maybe we can engage in that together between a couple of GPs, and we can now stack our efforts, and, you know, we can get the best compliance background for all of us. Obviously, talk about efficient pricing when it comes to doing that type of strategy. But I think they're important conversations to have, because maybe your partner isn't thinking about that. Maybe they could benefit from that, or maybe you couldn't benefit from that. Your partner has the idea to say, hey, we should talk about this. But I would agree. I mean, the LPAs are just a CYA for the GPs. So As an investor, you know, be cognizant in reading those, be very thorough, engage another professional to do that. Obviously, there's firms that really do specialize in that. Obviously, Kirkland always comes to mind, Logan Loeb. I mean, those are always good players. There's lots of good mid-sized players as well in that area.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you think about Mitt Romney, How he famously put his carry into an IRA vehicle. Early on, and just, I mean, incredible appreciation and tax efficient way to structure his carried interest at Bain. it makes a big difference.
Oh, I mean, it makes a huge difference. Yeah, I think somebody at PayPal did the same thing with their stock, you know, put it in like day one into an IRA, or, and it was just like, wow, like talk about a powerful, or I think it was a Roth IRA. And it was like, wow, like talk about a payoff right there.
So if we haven't lost everyone in the audience, we're going to go even deeper here.
Yeah.
Can you talk about carried interest derivative sales and what the vertical slice rule is? And for people listening, when we go in this in depth, I think it's important. You don't need to understand exactly what Anthony is saying, but recognize the fact patterns and the situations that he describes and know enough to ask a professional. When you hear a setup like this, think about, okay, I need to ask somebody about these type of things. That's generally how I approach these conversations, because it can get really technical really quickly. But it's more about, oh, wait, hold on a second. I should ask my CPA about this or my tax attorney about this.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, this is kind of like catching an ad for a medication on the TV and saying, well, I should go talk to my doctor about this, right? Go talk to your CPA. Go talk to your attorney about it. Ideally, they can speak to this stuff. Or, I mean, I work with lots of outside CPAs, so I'm happy to be a part of that conversation too if it's helpful. But yeah, for anyone who's still awake in line and decides this isn't technical enough, let's get deep with it. So obviously, we've talked about carry interest planning, and that's great. I would love to just pick off my carry and gift that. Unfortunately, we're restricted by Internal Revenue Code 2703. Now, that dictates that I can't just go cherry pick an interest off. We have what's called the vertical slice rule. So the vertical slice rule would dictate, let's say I'm a partner in a private equity fund. I can't just give off my carried interest. I have to give off a prorated amount of every other interest I have in that fund. And that would include typically my direct interest from GP. It could also include things like deemed contributions, interest I have in maybe a sponsor fund or something else related to it. Those can be very onerous, right? So now when we contribute my direct interest, which has a much lower appreciation potential, I'm still benefiting from the strategy overall, yes, but it can be less powerful. I can also start running into an administrative issue. That could be now my trust has to get admitted as a partner to my GP entity. And that can now be a burden, and that could even be a deal breaker for some funds. So it'd be nice if there's a way we could just pick off the carry in a strategic way that doesn't make me have to get into the LPA and the GP-LPA on part of this process. So we have what's called a carried interest derivative. So carried interest derivative contract would be a contract between me as GP of the fund and typically my trust for, you know, my descendant, whoever. And that would then stipulate that I would pay carried interest out to that trust in excess of a hurdle amount, which I would typically be engaged to calculate that hurdle amount, but that would typically be set very low. Now I've functionally just created a call option that I'm selling out to this trust. I sell it to the trust, and then alternatively, I also fund the trust with cash, but that's at fair market value. So I can lock in that huge appreciation potential, right? I can make a gift with it. I don't have to get in the LPA. I have now gotten around 2703 because I'm not gifting interest in the carry. I'm gifting a separate derivative contract between me and my trust. Or I'm actually technically only gifting cash. I'm selling that derivative contract. The thing to take away here is that it's now addressed IRC 2703, which I could have just safe harbored and gifted through, but lost some efficiency. Instead, I've addressed that. I maintain the efficiency, and in some ways, even more efficient potentially, depending on the performance of the fund itself.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
So I think just taking a step back, if anyone's still staying with us, kudos to you. If you're in a situation where, you know, you're a GP or you're in the GP business or somebody that you know is, make sure that you understand these concepts and that you're engaging with a CPA, tax attorney who understands the private equity space. And again, the more and more I think about it, you need somebody who is representing your interests, who understands the connectivity between your income and estate tax.
Yeah.
And like how those two things work together and how they can work together, not in isolation. So that would be my...
Yeah, huge there. I think that's the thing that really sells it, is that this conversation has strictly been focused on federal, you know, gift and estate tax, right? We could have state estate tax issues. New York State comes to mind as one that has a very onerous estate tax, right? And typically, if I'm in private equity, there's a good chance I live in New York. So there's opportunities
there.
This is
why so many people relocated to Nashville, yeah. My hometown, the glorious state with no state income tax. Yeah.
We're going to tax them on the way out, I think is the way it's going. Yeah, exactly. But so there's that. Then also we can talk about income tax planning opportunities, this holistic discussion. But this is where the conversations we were alluding to earlier break down when you get super multidisciplinary. The important thing to have is that people who are knowledgeable enough to understand, be confident with know what they know, have a working understanding of the adjacent services around them, and be able to communicate effectively between each other, right? There's a lot of inside baseball terms going around here, so we need to know those as a precursor. I don't need to know necessarily the ins and outs of IRC 2703 if I'm the tax accountant, but I have to know enough to ask the right people, bring the right people into the fray, work from there.
Yeah, and maybe just a public service announcement. If you're an ultra high net worth individual or family office that has an estate tax liability issue, you need to start thinking about the world on an after-tax basis and pay up for really good advice on the front end, because you will always get it back on the back end when the bill comes.
Yeah.
Do you have maybe an anecdote, or if people are winding this down, big picture takeaways of best practices or what people should be thinking about if they're obviously deep in this issue and this is a kitchen table conversation for them right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that conversation needs to start at the kitchen table. First, establish what my goals are. What are my family's goals? What are our planning goals? That's obviously holistic. That's not just financial, but financial can be a big component of that. Once I've laid those out, I would typically talk to probably my family office if I'm in that situation and say, hey, here are my goals. Here's what I want to accomplish. How do we do that? The next strategy would be if estate tax is an issue that you see for yourself, how do we start addressing that? And addressing that through gifting is the best process. Obviously, there's other carryover benefits. I think we're obviously going to see that estate tax change in the next year and a half now. That's going to be significant. We see continued proposals of raising that estate tax amount and lowering the exemption amount. So I think that's only going in one direction. Certainly, if you look at our forecasted budget and deficit. So that's an important conversation. I also think if we're looking at even broader, longer term, Moore versus United States is in front of the Supreme Court right now. And that would basically either set the basis or eliminate the possibility of a wealth tax, right? A lot of these estate planning strategies are going to have carryovers to other benefits and their future taxation structures. We don't think in the current paradigm alone, but where it's going, I think it's important to start addressing those. Certainly if we're talking about generations, if we're talking about a couple of generations out, you just care about, you know, yourself and your current generation. You think your kids are set up with, you know, the house or something, you're leaving them. That's wonderful. But longer term, if you're concerned with that, these are conversations to be having today.
Yeah. Anthony, I want to thank you for coming on. This has been very insightful and helpful, and appreciate your technical expertise as well as your kind of relationship-driven approach to things.
Yeah.
I think it's really powerful.
Yeah, I was out speaking at a college campus this week, and we were talking about skill sets. And I said, right, there's my technical skills, my soft skills, and my relationships. Those are the three buckets I put in. At the end of the day, it all gravitates back to relationships. This is just a relationship business. These are just widgets and X's and O's, but we're here to help people achieve their goals, and I want to solve interesting problems while I do it. So that's why I love talking about carry interest, because I can do both those things at once.
Yeah, well, you're clearly passionate about it, which is awesome. For our listeners, please do leave us a review and a rating. Let us know your favorite part of the conversation. Anthony, a question we ask people that come on the show, do you have a daily practice that helps bring peace to your life?
Oh, gosh. Kettlebell swings.
Nice. My kind of guy right there. My kind of guy. You do like the complexes and, you know, the whole thing, or?
I trained at a strong first gym for a couple of years. So I typically do 100 swings a day plus whatever else goes with it. So yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
You listen to anything while you do it, or is it just like silent rage time?
You know, music, podcasts. I'm usually stuck in my own head trying to get air in. I like it as a daily practice because it's a struggle alone to breathe, and maybe that's now where my focus becomes, and you have no option but to be present when that thing's moving through the air.
I think that's the best part about exercise, is that it doesn't allow you room for anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a good step for people to have that step away and say, this is what I'm doing right now, and nothing else matters but getting through this set. And that's an important presence moment to have.
Love it.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing. Thanks again for coming on. Best of luck moving forward and keep putting out great content. Super helpful. So I appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you for having me on, Brian.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.